Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What is it about Ukraine that makes the West delusional, senseless, and outright dangerous? Ukraine will never be a member of NATO. Ukraine will probably never be part of the European Union. Western pursuit of both goals has little to do with Ukraine, actually, but rather a messianic hatred of Russia. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guests, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Goggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Marrakesh, we have Martin Jay. He is an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. Well, Zelensky and his regime got a little bit of public relations success, you know, the European Union minus Hungary, which Viktor Orban went for a coffee, apparently. And then they passed, you know, this world historic event, you know, to start the accession of Ukraine into NATO. Well, yeah, it was a photo op and, you know, they all got to sing Kumbaya, but it's basically quite meaningless at this point. And by the way, George, the Hungarians still can vote a veto many more times down the road during this process. George.
No, that's absolutely right. And it is a very interesting issue that you raise about this extraordinary emotional attachment to Ukraine, because Ukraine, as we know, is not a member of NATO. It's not a member of the European Union. It has no real, you know, relationship with the rest of Europe. And however, the elites in Europe, the elites in the United States just will not let this go. They will not say, well, you know, our interests are this. And, you know, sorry, but Ukraine isn't really a part of it. But instead, it's become this this thing that they obsess over. And over again, they berate anybody who dissents from the need to sacrifice everything for Ukraine. And there's no question that, you know, a great part of it is the hatred for Russia, the need to do something about Russia, to destroy Russia. And but otherwise, it's really it has no real, you know, rationale for it. And again, we see that, you know, among the public, that there's very little interest in this war. They're kind of, the public itself is rather baffled by why are we involved in this. And yet, when you listen to the television pundits, you listen to the politicians, anybody who's not on board for all the way with Ukraine is somehow a moral reprobate. An extraordinary phenomenon.
Yeah, well, Martin, we've seen a change in the discourse. As long as it takes, it has morphed into as long as we can. Okay, I don't know how many people noticed that. But, you know, Martin, you come from a country that was in the European Union. So what is the value added for the European Union to have a country like Ukraine, where everybody else is paying their bills, their economic vitality is not even worth mentioning at this point. It's a country on the global dole. And still, you know, there's something that we've talked about many times before. I don't know why anyone's talking about Ukraine's future, because the present hasn't completely played itself out that will create that future. So why does the European Union, that already has a lot of problems, want to bring in a beggar?
Because it always thinks bigger is better. And when I was in Brussels in 2004 and I witnessed the first expansion of all the Eastern European countries, then there was a huge euphoria of this idea that the bigger we get, the further we spread, the more influence we have, the bigger a player we are on the world stage. And I think, you know, Ukraine was a bridge too far. I think it was just one last country that the European Union probably didn't need. It certainly didn't need all the baggage that came with it, but the sweetener there, I suppose, for the EU and for the West, was that it was an opportunity to hit Russia. And we know now, you know, we discussed on this show now for months about the first opportunity of a peace talks in Istanbul, where Zelensky's lot basically shrugged their shoulders and said, "Look, we've been offered not a bad deal by Russia, And Boris Johnson was flown in to scupper the whole thing and said, no way, no way, we are going to fight. This is a great opportunity. We're never going to get another shot like this handed to us on a plate. So the whole story about, to come back to your point, it's all about winners and losers. At the beginning, the West, NATO, and EU saw Ukraine as a wonderful way to promote itself, to shine, to seem to be so much bigger and more prolific at everything it does. And now we're looking at the losing scenario. Now Ukraine is becoming an embarrassment and a liability. Because if we carry on pouring money into this black hole, you know, where will it take us? Biden may well not be reelected because of it. You know, the Tory government in the UK may fall. The European Union has its elections next June in 2024. It may well, for the first time in its history, have a majority of far-right MEPs in the European Parliament, which would be absolutely amazing. You know, so we're now looking at Ukraine as this recalcitrant orphan child who we'd actually rather like to get rid of, you know, because it's really becoming such a liability. But there is still this romantic inclination, this attachment to Ukraine that, you know, we might get there. We might just get through to the end and raise this child properly and give her or him a future. But it's not looking good, is it? Particularly in the events of the last week.
You know, yeah, it's very interesting, George. I mean, they talk about democracy. Actually, I have to say they've talked less and less about democracy over the last half year because Ukraine isn't really one anymore. And it isn't going to have elections. It doesn't have opposition parties. It's attacking the church left, right, and center. But, you know, going back to the European Union's grasp to expand here. Okay, Viktor Orban went for coffee, and then, it was basically an abstention. But he did veto money, and that's what really matters in all of this here. You know, the photo ops, everyone patting each other on the back, they'll put a plaque up somewhere. But now, as the great philosopher Bob Dylan said, money doesn't talk, it screams, George.
Well, that's right. On the other hand, Orban is a deal maker like other politicians. He got a nice chunk of change. I mean, money
that's right.
Hungary was entitled to. He got the 10 billion euros. That, I think, sweetened the deal for him. And that's why he was willing to go along with this deal with Macron and Scholz, whereby he would leave the room. And then just as he left the room for the coffee, okay, right, everybody get the vote done. And so that's what he got for the 10 billion. There's still 20 billion euros that he's owed. So we'll see what he might do to get those 20
billion. Well, George, apropos is really interesting. I was looking at some of the mainstream coverage of it all. And Orban, good friend of Vladimir Putin. They always have to comma, good friend of the Kremlin. They always stick that in. I always find that interesting. He's elected how many times, George? Four times in a row?
Landslides, yeah.
Okay. I guess the people like him there. Okay. Yeah. But it's really interesting. You know how he's a blackmailer. Okay. And what's the worst thing you do to a blackmailer? You give in because he'll come back over and over again. That's how he's being described. Okay. I think he played it masterfully. He got what he wanted, George. That's what politics is about, isn't it?
Exactly. But, you know, Orban has many enemies within the EU, and all the leading political blocs in the European Parliament wrote letters last week to the European Commission. Don't give Orban anything. Don't give him these 10 billion euros. Nothing. Because, as you said, he's a blackmailer. You know, he'll come back for more. So to get those additional 20 billion euros, I think, you know, it's going to be quite a challenge for him. But the problem is that, you know, again, it goes back to this emotional attachment is that, well, that's just Orban. That's one out of 27. The question then is, why did the other 26 go along with this? What's in it for them? What do they think they're getting out of it? Same with, you know, we got the battle in Congress over the budget, you know, giving 61 billion for Ukraine. I mean, the media parade, the Republicans, the revolting, horrible Republicans refusing to give Ukraine what it needs. But of the Republicans, it's only a small percentage of them that are being obdurate. They have inordinate influence because the Republicans have such a small majority. But the big news is, well, why does 90% of Congress actually want to give the $61 billion. It's only about 10% of Congress comprised by these obdurate Republicans that are being difficult. 90% want to do it. Why? What do they think they're getting out of it?
What's really interesting is, you know, Martin, the, you know, it's talking about that small cadre of Republicans here. In a way, I suppose, the secretly on their bedstand, they have a little, they have a portrait of Zelensky, because Zelensky will maybe help bring about securing the American southern border. Who knew how valuable he could be for American conservatives? Go ahead, Martin.
That's a huge question, isn't it? Whether this border issue, you know, becomes the deal breaker for opening up more checks, more a greater sluice of military aid from America or not. At the moment, we're all shrugging our shoulders and wondering, you know, what's going to happen next. Least of all, Zelensky himself, who got on the plane and went back to Kiev with a very, very heavy heart. I mean, put yourself in his shoes. You know, he has to go back and tell his cabal, his dirty dozen of ministers and senior military figures, I've got no more money for you. The racket's up, you know. And what are those? I mean, I think what we'll see now
In finance, he's called the Rain Man. Well, the rain isn't coming anymore.
The rain's not coming anymore. So what happens to those people and what happens to their own personal economies? They've got people to pay as well. This is how corruption works, you know. I think there are several scenarios which we might see unfold in the next few weeks or a couple of months. It may well be that one or two of those individuals might leave the country, but I think the pressure on Zelensky to step down will start to increase, because many of those individuals will be looking at the situation and say, okay, we've got no more money, nothing's coming in now. If we were to go for peace and then let the EU in with reconstruction aid, that would give us access to a whole lot more money in the future. We could set up fake NGOs. We could create loads of fake construction companies. That's how we could cream off the top again. So the pressure will always be the financial argument. But Zelensky's, he seems to me to be hanging on like a thread. I mean, there's a number of American journalists now are writing opinion pieces, and they are making references to his commander in chief and as a possible take, you know, as a possible new leader to take to replace him. So there's this new tone now, which we're seeing from the West. This is from Western commentators that, you know, his days are numbered. There's not much more to go. I mean,
Martin, you said you wouldn't want to be in his shoes. But George, I mean, you know, the thing is that, you know, Zelensky, Ukraine, the media likes to depict them as victims. I can understand that to a degree, but they're volunteers in all of this. And this is what's really peculiar, is that they volunteer. You gentlemen have been talking about the financial necessities here. Nobody's talking about the death toll in Ukraine. Okay, they're talking about how much money they can make. Okay, I usually don't end the program on a question and then we go to the break, but gentlemen, we're going to go to a break, and after that break we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Well, let's go back to George in Budapest. George, in our podcast a few days ago, we looked at the barrage of articles from legacy media, you know, The Atlantic and Washington Post, et cetera, how the return of Trump is, you know, he's a dictator in waiting, though he was already president and he wasn't a dictator. But, you know, we figured that out here. Then there's another stream going on. He said, Russia's staggering losses. Staggering was the word. Okay, staggering. 83%, 85% of its manpower has been killed. You know, the kill ratio is, you know, one, for every Ukrainian, it's 10 Russians, you know, this over and over again. Okay. And I saw it all across mainstream here. So George, Ukraine is winning and, you know, it's almost done. But George, but after Ukraine, Russia's going to invade Poland, and it's going to go into Germany. How can these two stories exist at the same time? Because they do.
That's right. Because this was time, the story about the 90% of Russian manpower has been wiped out by Ukraine, which apparently the findings of US intelligence and the media eagerly reported. This was released in time for Zelensky's visit. See, this was money well spent. We did a great job giving him all this money. We need to give him more. But then there's the other story, and this is being peddled by the Biden administration, including especially by Biden himself, which is that if we don't give Ukraine what it wants, Russia will win this war. And what happens then is that Russia will threaten NATO, and therefore United States will be directly involved in a shooting war with Russia. And now this has been put forward in a paper by the Institute for the Study of War, which is the go-to source for, you know, the legacy media. New York Times is always citing, well, according to the Institute for the Study of War, blah, blah, you know. This is another Kagan's outfit. This is Frederick Kagan, which is Robert Kagan's brother, and so on. So their argument is that Russia is now on the brink of complete victory. It's going to occupy the entirety of Ukraine, and therefore it will immediately be threatening Poland, the Baltic states, and this is a very serious situation for NATO. It says this is the worst situation we've been since the 1990s, when we had the massive Soviet forces to the east. So this is the new line, which is that, well, if we don't give Ukraine what it wants, we're going to be facing, well, in fact, Stalin and the Red Army in no time at all.
Well, you know,
how you combine these two, I don't know.
It was the same kind of argument in 1975 on, you know, funding Cambodia and on South Vietnam. I mean, the same kind. Oh, it's called the domino theory. I almost forgot. I mean, this is absurd here. And, you know, and plus, you know, at one point, you know, NATO is not involved in this conflict, but NATO is now needs to be poised to get involved in this conflict, which they already are. I mean, there's so many layers of this that don't make any sense. I mean, it's like five-dimensional chess without the pieces. Go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. The only thing that makes sense is that Biden is worried. He's worried about his own legacy and his own re-election bid. And, you know, we've mentioned on this show previously about the celebrations penciled in for NATO next June, for the 75th birthday. It's going to be pretty difficult for NATO and Biden to stand up there and you know, watch the fireworks and do the silly handshakes when Ukraine is just such a disaster zone. So I think something has to be done. And they are really scratching, they're really, really scraping the barrel now, looking for possible solutions. And I think the EU membership thing, you know, hilarious as it was, I think was a token measure to keep the Americans happy at the moment and offer media a distraction to the bigger story, which is, you know, obviously that Ukraine is sinking. And by the time the dust settles, I mean, I feel sorry for Zelensky's wife, who was misquoted by The Economist this week. She said, I really don't want my husband to stand a second term as president. Now, what she really meant, it's hilarious, what she really meant was, if we ever get to the situation where we have free and fair elections, and that means the war is over, then in this scenario, in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years time, I wouldn't want my husband to stand again. But, you know, what's going to happen, I think, in Ukraine is, I mentioned earlier, is I think a confidence crisis is emerging for Zelensky himself. And I think that may well suit the Biden administration if he can be convinced to step aside or move out. There's an intelligence officer, apparently an American intelligence officer, who's gone online and leaked documents, papers, proving that the Biden administration has actually prepared some sort of US citizenship for Zelensky. Now, whether those papers are fake or not, I don't know. They've been backed up by at least one CIA officer that I've read about. They said they look pretty genuine. They've set him up with a home in Florida with maximum security, you can imagine. So, you know, that's a possibility. I know George disagrees with me, and I'll bet George.
Well, I haven't seen these reports. I mean, is this a government in exile, or is it just a payoff?
No. I think it's an exile deal where they give them, you know, maximum protection and
well, and who is going? I mean, George, I'm sorry, I'm going to say the obvious here. So he's been residing in Kiev now for the last 2 years, and he's lived, okay. But if he goes into exile, he may be killed in Florida. Who's going to do that, George? I mean, the Russians could have killed him anytime they wanted. I mean, The absurdity of, you know, Zelensky flying around the world. I mean, you know, and the airport isn't attacked. Obviously, the for the Russian side, Zelensky is an asset, you know, because of his antics. Okay, it's worked very well. But if he goes to Florida, he could have his life threatened. We all know who would threaten him there, and it wouldn't be the Russians, George.
No, that's right. The thing is that for the Americans. I have to say that, I mean, we talked about, you know, all the money drying up and so on, but I think ultimately they will come up with some money. The $61 billion, that isn't on, but they're working on a deal. I mean, they're sitting there negotiating, and they're going to get him something. You know, there's obviously some deal in the works, may not happen before Christmas, but it may happen in January. The Americans have invested a great deal in Ukraine. They're not just going to abandon it. That's just not the way the Americans operate. They're going to try and get what they
can. After 20 years, they did in Afghanistan.
That, 20 years. I mean, that's a big. It took a long time for them to abandon.
Yeah, but Russia isn't the Taliban in this case,
right? So no, but, okay, exactly. But that's why this is for them. They still regard this as a good investment because, again, even $61 billion. A lot of money, but it's nothing. It's pocket change for the United States.
Well, George, let's split the difference. Let's split the difference. Keep it going until the election. Agreed?
Yeah, I think so.
And At the very least. Okay, Martin, jump in.
No, I disagree. I'd bet both of you at Creative Guinness that I think Zelensky is going to be pushed out by the Biden administration. A deal is going to be struck and he's going to be got out, and possibly before the NATO birthday.
Replaces him? A military? Well, it already is a junta, a military man.
Yeah. I mean, probably. I mean, that's the most likely scenario, isn't it? Is that the commander-in-chief himself will take over. He seems to be popular and he seems to be effective. Exactly. Yeah, Valerie Zelensky.
Right, but if I could ask Margaret, what would the deal be then? What would the fight? I mean, okay, you replace him by Zelensky. Then what? What's the deal?
In the short term, some sort of armistice, some sort of ceasefire, and then longer negotiations after that.
But the problem is, Martin, is the Russians would have to agree to that.
Yeah. Yeah, or if they got no agreement at all, the fact that he was replaced and a different tactic. A different policy.
Okay, how about Trotsky's no peace, no war?
Yeah, well, no, I think the Putin is a very smart guy. He's not going to blow it. You know, if he sees a sea change on the American side, and he sees the possibility of back channel talks to work out some sort of informal armistice where he keeps what he's got already, no negotiation whatsoever for those territories that are already taken, you know, and no NATO deal, he may well be happy with that. He may not need to.
But how's that not a defeat for Russia? Because then you've got a rump state Ukraine that will be scooped up into NATO. I mean, they're going to do it for the 75th birthday party. And they'll say, well, what's left of Ukraine, the part that Russia hasn't taken, okay, is going to be a member of NATO. So how's that not a defeat for Russia?
I'm not sure it's a great defeat. I mean, it stops the war, and I think Putin wants that. I think he wants some solution in the longer term. The point about Zelensky, and I think Peter is absolutely right, Zelensky is an asset to Putin, because I think Putin definitely wants Zelensky to be around to sign the final deal, because that's what will give it maximum credibility.
But if before he could even sign a deal, he'll already be in Florida. Okay, that's why these pieces don't work for me. Okay, again. You know, George, the problem with so much of this creating a hypothesis for a ceasefire, for an end of the conflict, very often, even people that are very kind of sympathetic to wanting to end it, they almost never take into account how Russia would react. Okay, Russia's in the driving seat right now. Why would it change course?
No, I agree with you, and I think that. Putin has said many times that this war is not about land. So the idea that he's going to say he'll be happy with, say, taking 20% of Ukraine, Russia's achieved something, that wasn't the objective. That wasn't what the whole purpose of the so-called special military operation was. It was to ensure that Ukraine was not a member of NATO. That's the part that Russia had to secure. And that's why, in a sense, these doomsday scenarios by the Institute for the Study of War have a certain logic to them, because they kind of figure out this is Russia's objective. Russia's objective is that Ukraine, you know, basically will not be a part of NATO. Ukraine will be in Russia's orbit. And that has to be the ultimate objective of Russia. Just simply, oh, they get a bit of territory, but the rest of Ukraine is a member of NATO. Then you'd have to say, well, then what has the war achieved?
All right, but let me ask George a question, if I can just chime in there, because you asked me one. To fire one back at you, what happens in this present scenario? How does the present status quo continue? You know, you're looking at, in the last 6 months, estimates of 120,000 Ukrainian troops killed, you know, Zelensky's popularity under question, you know, the country's falling and falling. We don't see a quick fix militarily from the West. You know, it's all very well talking about getting aid at some point, but how do you see the next 6 months in Ukraine?
20 seconds, George.
Well, I think ultimately Russia has to push forward for a victory. I think that there can be no other goal but to essentially topple the regime in Kiev and get a regime there that will work out some kind of a deal with Russia. Anything else, I think, will not be a success.
Okay, I'm going to just put a pause on this because we'll continue this discussion next week. I want to thank my guests in Marrakesh and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here on RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.